tonight's agenda is to think about idolatry. I would like to spend the first part of this evening doing a careful reading of chapter 10 of the book of Jeremiah, which is kind of one of the central texts about and polemics against idolatry. And then in the second part of tonight, to maybe zoom out a little bit and talk about larger questions of idolatry in biblical theology. We will also see, I can't decide quite yet, depends how long it's going to take us, whether we'll do the end of this chapter. And if we do, we'll also see the culmination of a theme that is present throughout the chapter, which is God's condemnation of the nations that that oppress Israel. Though no texts from Isaiah are cited, there's an obvious connection here between Jeremiah and Isaiah. The idea that nations are first brought by God to punish Israel, and then in turn are themselves condemned for their cruelty and failure to acknowledge God. What we're going to see in the first 16 verses of this chapter, in particular, a really interesting kind of alternation between mockery of the idols and hymnic praise of God, which creates this kind of literary and almost experiential effect of powerful contrast between God on the one hand and the idols on the other. The contrast between God and the idols is hardly unique, but the alternation, the technique of alternating back and forth between singing hymns to God and belittling the idols is actually a unique technique that we find in this chapter. Now, what is it, can we say at bottom, that is so disturbing about idolatry from a philosophical and theological perspective for these texts? I think that what we'll see is that the real problem with idols is that they are made, which serves in stark contrast to God, who makes all that is the whole creation, right? The problem with an idol is that it's man-made. And I think, by the way, implicitly, therefore, idol worship is a form of self-worship. It's humans worshiping something human, as opposed to worshiping something that is decidedly other than human, other than worldly. This gets played out as a kind of ongoing contrast between the gods who did not make heaven and earth with God who did make heaven and earth. And by the way, not only made heaven and earth, but actively continues to be involved in creative activity. And I'm just going to belabor the point I made a moment ago and say, where is our hope generated? Is it generated in things that we ourselves produce, or does it come from elsewhere? Is it a gift from someone who is not us, but is beyond and other than us? Okay, I'll stop belaboring that point, but I think that that is essential to understanding what is going to unfold here. For people like many of us, for whom it is extremely important that all conversations about other religions are carried on in the most respectful way possible, a text like Jeremiah or Isaiah is obviously somewhat jarring, because Jeremiah's thesis is that the religion, I'm not sure which one we should say, of the nations is hollow, is fake, and ultimately deserves nothing so much as mockery. Their gods are literally stupid. They can't talk, they can't walk, they can't move, they can't enter into relationship, and they are destined to be exposed as stupid, as deceptive, and destined to perish. And in contrast to all that, of course, God is the smartest, the most powerful, and crucially, I want to say, the most relational. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. And here, I want to just underscore, and then we're going to turn to the text, something that has been argued by the Bible scholar Terry Fredheim, who we've talked about earlier, the commandments regarding the prohibition on making images are often thought to guard God's transcendence. But as we'll see from this chapter, the commandment seems just as concerned with guarding God's relatedness, right? In other words, people sometimes talk about idolatry as, oh, because God is so transcendent that if you make an idol, you are compromising God's transcendence. But in fact, it seems like one of the things that concerns this text is if you make an idol, you are making something that pretends to be a god, but is not relational. And God, God, capital G God, is relational. Interpreters also sometimes suggest that the prohibition of images serves to protect God's freedom. But texts like these seem to suggest that the prohibition on idolatry serves to protect God's ability to enter into committed relationship. Idols do not make commitments, right? That is really kind of important. So again, what I want to underscore following Fredheim here, who I think is onto something important, is how much the polemic against idolatry wants to defend the idea of a God who is in relationship with human beings, as opposed to one who is unable to be in relationship because fundamentally not alive. Okay, and with that, let's turn to the text, chapter 10 of Jeremiah. Shim'u et hadavar asher diber Adonai aleichem Beit Yisrael. Hear the word which God has spoken to you, O house of Israel. Ko amar Adonai, thus said the Lord, El derech hagoyim al tilmadu. Don't learn to go the way that the nations go. Umeotot hashamayim al techatu. And do not be frightened by the signs in the sky. Ki echatu hagoyim mehema. Let the nations be afraid of them. Now, just context of what's going on here, astrology was a powerful presence in the time of Jeremiah, in Babylonia and also elsewhere, but especially for our purposes in Babylonia. And the prophet is here urging the people, don't get seduced by this or pay any attention to it. Don't get seduced by the idea of paying attention to the stars, to the signs in heaven. Okay, Pasuk Gimel. Ki chukot ha'amim hevel hu. Ki eitz miya'ar karato. Ma'aseh yedei charash b'matzad. For the chukot of the nations, I don't know what chukot means there, we'll get to that in a minute, are mere breath, are delusions, are nothing. For, because, it is the work, like JPS, I will take these next two clauses out of order. Because it is the work of a craftsman, he cuts down a tree in the forest using his axe. Chukot ha'amim, JPS translates the laws of the nations. Some translators translate the practices of the nations, but they are translating practices only because the context requires something like that, because otherwise the verse doesn't make any sense. Chukot ha'amim sounds like the laws of the nations, but it's a very weird statement. The laws of the nations are delusions, and then to go on and describe the idols, the practices or the worship maybe even of the nations would make more sense here. And then what is described here is kind of an image of an individual idolater who cuts down the tree, right, carves it, and as we'll see in the next verse, overlays it with gold and silver. As Robert Alter points out, and many others as well, the point here is the absurdity of attributing divinity to an object that has been made through human craftsmanship. Or, bechesef uvizahav yeyapehu, bemasmerot uvimakavot yichaskum velo yafik. He adorns it. He makes it beautiful with silver and gold. He makes it tight with nails and a hammer so that it does not totter. Now, yiyapeyu The Targum seems to read Yitzapehu, will coat it, which works well too. Velo Yafik, I think, is already moving into making fun of these idols. These idols have to be fastened well, lest they start tottering. I would like to observe something that we're going to come back to a bunch in these verses. As is typical in the rhetoric of Tanakh, the physical representation of these gods, that is, these idols, are deliberately conflated with the deities they represent. There is a deliberate conflation between the idol and what the idol represents. As we will see later on, biblical Israel enjoyed making fun of idolaters by insisting that they thought that the idols they worshipped were themselves the gods. But very few people think that when they worship an icon. They usually think an icon represents something rather than being the thing itself. And now we're going to begin to make fun of them. Kitomer mikshahema velo yedaberu. They are like scarecrows in, they are like a scarecrow in a cucumber patch. That is not a flattering way of describing an idol. Nasogi nasu kilo yitzadu. They must be carried, velo yedaberu. And they cannot speak. They are carried because they cannot walk. Al tiru mehem kilo yareyu. Don't be afraid of them because they can't harm you. Vegam heitiv einotam, nor do they have the capacity to help you. This is a little bit over the top, but Christopher Wright, who's an evangelical Bible scholar, comments about Tomer Miksha that this is the most richly comic metaphor for idolatry ever invented. Maybe. There are other attempts to translate Tomer Miksha, but we'll go with this one. And then we get to verse 6. Notice, we're going to go now to hymning God. Me'ein kamocha Adonai, gadol ata, v'gadol shimcha, bigvura. O Lord, there is none like you. You are great, and your name is great. Now, me'ein kamocha may mean something like, because, O Lord, there is none like you. Like, that's why everything else is nothing. What's interesting is that verses 2-5 that we just read had the form of a message from God. And now the prophet, as it were, kind of forgets that he's speaking for God and finds himself speaking to God, but doing so in a way that they can overhear. And so indirectly, he's addressing them, right? Sometimes you think about like on stage, one character addresses another, but really he's addressing a third character that's not explicitly in the dialogue, but is implicitly in the dialogue. Here, Jeremiah addresses the people by addressing God. And I want to just observe, Me'en kamocha Adonai, I'm not totally sure that I'm right about this, but it does seem to me to be right. Me'en kamocha Adonai, gadol ata v'gadol shimcha bigvura. This seems to me to be a step beyond saying something like, Michamocha ba'ilim Hashem, who is like you among the gods, O God. Right? Here, there's no other gods to talk about. We have progressed to a late enough point in the development of biblical thinking that God is not just incomparable, but absolutely incomparable. So we have a move here towards a more robust monotheism. Another way of saying that, in case it's not clear, especially for those of you who were educated in traditional Jewish environments, you know, Michamocha ba'elim Hashem, who is like you among the Lord, among the deities, O God, is really interesting because what traditional apologists feel the need to do is to say, oh, Michamocha ba'elim Hashem, like the JPS translation, who is like you among the celestials, whatever that is. Right? But the truth is, unless Elim means gods, it's not that much of a compliment. If I walk up to a 12th grader and say, 12th grader, you are so mighty. You are mightier than all the 8th graders. 12th grader is going to be like, really? That's your compliment for me? Who is like me among the angelic beings? No, I want to know that I'm the most powerful among the 12th graders. Mi chamocha ba'ilim Hashem, who is like you among the gods. By the time you get to Jeremiah here, there are no puny other gods to compare God to. God is truly incomparable. Gadol Shimcha Bigvura is an incredibly interesting thing to say when the Babylonians either were about to say, or more likely for this chapter, I think, were already saying, that the deity that Israel worshipped had just suffered a crushing defeat at the hands of their god, the Babylonian god. Jeremiah, in contrast, insists that Hashem, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is the sovereign who has been controlling these very Babylonians with that strength. This is the thing. Can I just say, this is one of the great paradoxes of the unfolding of monotheism. You ready for this? Maybe this will sound not surprising to you, but I think it's actually kind of breathtaking. It is precisely through the humiliating defeat at the hands of Babylonia that Israelite monotheism becomes more robust and the God of Israel becomes more omnipotent. Because rather than say, oh, their God defeated us, Israel then goes to say, no, our God even controls that. Our God controls all the peoples. So in a very strange way, the need to explain defeat leads you to a more robust conception of God. It is God who is in fact controlling the Babylonians. So your name is great in power or something like that is a really striking thing to say. And then verse 7, Mi lo yira'acha melech hagoyim, who would not revere you, O king of the nations? Now this is the definition of irony, because the answer is, oh, I don't know, most of the Judahites? Right? Who would not revere you, O God? I don't know, all the idolatrous Judahites. But the point is, this is another way of Jeremiah saying that the people are stupid. Right? Remember, we've talked about this a bunch of times, that idolatry is not just wrong for Jeremiah, it's dumb. I mean, who would not revere this all-powerful God, this incredibly powerful God? The Israelites or the Judahites? Well, they're stupid. Kilechayata, because for you, it is due. Kivechol chachmei hagoyim uvechol machutam me'ein kamocha. Because among all the wise of the nations and in all their royalty or kingdom, there is none like you. And then, verse 8, which is hard. Uve'achat yiv'aru v'yichsalu. But they are at once stupid and foolish. Musar havalim etu. You don't really know how to translate musar havalim etu. JPS, as you see, translates, their doctrine is delusion. It is a piece of wood. But then says the meaning of Hebrew is the uncertain. It is a doctrine of mere breath. It is merely wood, something like that. I guess I do know how to translate it. It's just, I'm not totally sure it's right, but it means something like that. Like the thing that they worship, the thing that they believe is stupid. It's actually just wood. Now, again, if I were a historian of antiquity, I might feel the need to point out here, yeah, but that's probably not true that they believed that the wood was God. They believed that the wood was an icon that represented their God. But for Jeremiah, again, the polemical move here, and I'll talk a little bit later about why Jeremiah perhaps feels justified in making this polemical move. But the polemical move is to say, oh no, their God is this piece of wood. Okay, let's go to verse 9. Kesef miruka mitarshish yuva, v'zahav me'ufaz, ma'aseicha rash v'yedei tzoref, tchelet v'argaman levusham, ma'aseicha chamim kulam. Silver beaten down from Tarshish, brought from Tarshish, gold from Uffaz, the work of a craftsman and the hands of a goldsmith. Blue and purple are they clothed in. All of them are the work of skilled people. Now, Tarshish and Uffaz, we don't really know where either of them is. Tarshish, we know that various biblical texts suggest that it was located somewhere in the Mediterranean and was reachable by ship, although it was far from Israel. So I think the idea here is that they're bringing, you know, all kinds of fancy stuff from all kinds of places, but it's bottom line, it's the work of human hands. Uffaz, we don't know where it is. Some people think Uffaz should be amended to Ophir, which was a place known in the book of Melachim Aleph as a source of gold. Maasei Chachamim Kulam, I think, is ironic. Chachamim literally means smart people. Here, Chachamim means craftsmen. But the idea is to mock the idea that a smart person could think this is a god. As Mitzudat David, early modern rabbinic commentary says, commenting on the word Chachamim here, Eich yasku Chachamim bidvar shtut kaze. How can these smart people do something so moronic? Okay, so I think the word is intended to be read both ways. It's literally the works of a craftsman, but if you think it's a work of a smart person would never do this. Okay, verse 10. V'adonai Elohim emet, hu Elohim chayim u'melech olam, mikitzpo tirash ha'aretz v'lo yachlu goyim za'amo. I think we could spend a few weeks on the first half of this verse trying to understand all the things that it means and has meant. V'adonai Elohim emet. JPS, but the Lord is truly God. Perhaps the Lord is the God of truth. Perhaps the Lord is God who is truth. The Lord is the God who is truth, something like that. Now, the point here is that in contrast, this ve is but, right? In contrast to the idols, this God is the real God. The real God, as opposed to something false and empty, whose appearance may convince some people that it's divine, but it is in fact nothing but hevel. Hu Elohim chayim u'melech olam. He is either the living God or a living God. I'd be tempted to say the living God, but he is the living God u'melech olam, the king who lasts forever. In other words, the claim here is that God is the only God who is true, living, lasting. But maybe even not only the only God who is true, living, and lasting, but the only reality that is true, living, and lasting. And God is living not only as opposed to dead, but as opposed to lifeless and motionless, like the idols who need to be carried from one place to another. And then the second half says, right, from his wrath the earth quakes, and the nations cannot bear his anger. Za'am means anger, but it also arguably carries the connotation of judgment, denunciatory judgment, something like that. And then comes a very strange thing. The only verse in the book of Jeremiah written in Aramaic, which on the surface, at first glance at least, would suggest that it's a later gloss from when Aramaic was the spoken language. But it is striking that it's also present in the Greek, and if you like the alternating structure I've been talking about between idols being stupid and fake and empty, and God being hymned, we need this verse to be original. Just a little context here, Aramaic was becoming the main spoken language of the Near Eastern world at the time of Jeremiah, and it's possible that the editor of this text means to suggest that non-Israelites, among whom these exiles find themselves could be told this in their own language. When you were invited to participate in idolatry, you could answer them in their own language. This, by the way, is the only complete verse in Tanakh that's in Aramaic, other than in the books of Daniel and Nehemiah, we have entire sections that are in Aramaic. I guess it's also possible, as some scholars suggest, that this is an incantation against foreign worship practices to be said, in other words, to the idols themselves. Not totally clear. Ki dina temrun lehom, Elohaya dishmaya ve'arka lo avadu, yevedu mi'ara u'minchot shmaya ela. Thus shall you say to them, let the gods, or may the gods, who did not make the heavens and the earth, perish from the earth and from under these very heavens. I think you could perhaps suggest, I'm not totally sure that I'm right about this, but I think you could perhaps suggest that here you find Jeremiah actually conceding that these idols are not actually the gods that they are meant to represent. Because here, all of a sudden, he's talking not about the images, but about the gods themselves. He's speaking now of the deities that he seems to understand that these idols represent, whose reality he appears to grant, even if only for the sake of argument, but who obviously are no parallel to the God of Israel. And then he goes on. I don't have much to say about these next couple of verses, but we're hymning God again. Ose eretz bekocho, mechin tevel bechochmato, uvitchunato nata shamayim. God made the earth with his power. God established the world with God's wisdom, and with God's understanding, God laid out the skies. L'kol tito hamon mayim bashamayim, v'ya'ale nisi'im mikze ha'aretz, brakim l'matar asa, v'yotze ruach me'otzrotav. When God makes God's voice heard, there is a rumbling of water in the skies. God makes vapors arise from the ends of the earth. God makes lightning for the rain and brings forth wind from God's treasuries. The idea here, I think, is God's total control of the world. And then now, notice something interesting isn't going to happen as we get to verse 14. This is going to be the first time that Israel, the Jewish people, if you pardon the anachronism, are mentioned in this chapter, which perhaps is meant to underline the universal claim that this poem is making about God as opposed to all the other gods. Niv'ar kol adam midat, hovish kol tzoreif mipesel, ki sheker nisko velo ruach bam. Now, the first sentence is meant to sort of like startle you, because it says, every man is an idiot devoid of knowledge, something like that. What it means is every man who is a goldsmith, right, on the one hand, has lots and lots of knowledge, but in another sense, shows himself stupid through that very knowledge because he uses his expertise to make images. Niv'ar kol adam midat. Hovish kol tzoreif mipasel. Right? Every goldsmith is brought to shame because of the idol, because the image he makes is a lie. There is no spirit in it, or there is no breath in it. Probably both of those. There's no breath and no spirit. And then, hevel hema. Ma'asei tatuim, be'et pekudatam yovedu. They are a delusion. Now, JPS here translates a work of mockery. I'm not convinced that that's right. I wonder whether the ma'asei tatuim is meant to be rendered as a work to be mocked, right? It's not that they are made as a mockery. It's that the proper relationship to them is to mock them. Hevel Hema, they are a delusion, ma'asei tatuim. They are to be mocked. Be'et v'kudatam yovedu, in the hour when God sort of responds to them, they will be destroyed. Ma'asei tatuim would be translated perhaps not as a work of mockery, but a work for mockery. Jack Lundbaum, the author of the Anchor, three-volume Anchor Bible, Jeremiah, translates Ma'aseh Tatuim as a joke, which I think is like an interesting colloquial rendering. Now, interesting question is, if that's right, who is supposed to do the mocking? Perhaps the Seifa, the conclusion of the verse, is meant to indicate that it is God, the God who will assure their doom, also mocks them. Then comes here the introduction of Israel. Lo che'ele chelek Yaakov, ki yotzer hakolhu. Not like these is the portion of Jacob, because he is the creator of all. V'Yisrael shevet nachalato, and Israel is his very own tribe. Adonai tzvaot shemo, the Lord of armies or hosts, is his name. Now, first let me just state the obvious. Note the intense reciprocity between God and Israel. God is the portion of Jacob, and Israel is God's very own tribe. They belong to each other. Remember what I said about how, in contrast to the idols, the God of the prophets and the God of Israel is a relational God. That's part of what makes God, God. Now, Chelek Yaakov is a sort of cool phrase that is worth dwelling on, because the term chelek refers usually to a share of land that signifies that a family has security and a future. But here, Jeremiah is using that image of a family's portion of land by saying God is the portion of Israel's land. Sorry, that was not. God is Israel's portion of land, is what I'm trying to say, right? It's the real chelek here is not a geographical thing, but actually God, God's self. Okay, Yotzer HaKol, I want to say, is a contrast to what we've just seen. God is the maker rather than the made. Hevel Hema Ma'aseh Tatuim, the idols were made, right? And in verse 14, that Tzoreith, the goldsmith, makes them, but not like that is God. God is Yotzer HaKol. God is the maker, not the made. When you hear the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, if you are Jewish or Christian Reformed or Eastern Orthodox, you are taught that you shall have no other gods before me, on the one hand, and you shall not make for yourself an idol, on the other, are two separate commandments. Hence, in the Jewish way of counting, lo tachmod, don't covet, is only one command. Because you have, the two commandments. You shall have no other gods, and you shall have no idols. If, on the other hand, you are Catholic or Lutheran, these two commandments are perceived as one. You'll have no other gods, and you shall not make for yourself an idol. And therefore, by the way, coveting is divided into two. Don't covet your neighbor's wife, don't covet your neighbor's house, as in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, each of these approaches, that these are two commands or that they are one command, points to something important in biblical tradition. The Jewish approach, again, according to which these are separate commandments, you shall have no other gods and you shall not make idols, worshiping gods other than Hashem, and using images in worship are two different phenomena, not merely two aspects of the same thing. In other words, there's two ways I can sin against my worship of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I can worship Baal, or I can make a picture of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh and bow down to that, right? Those are not the same thing. One is worshiping another god, And one is worshiping a visual representation of the one God. You're doing two separate things. And in some cases, at least, ancient Israelite texts believed that other gods were real, but are taboo to those who are committed to worshiping the ultimate God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, like I just said in response to Barbara. Now, in itself, the prohibition on images is a different issue than the prohibition of other gods and makes a different point, okay? You can't worship other gods, says something about divine power or something like that. Only one source more powerful than any other may be worshipped. But the prohibition on making of images says something about the character of this god. It can't be captured in any physical representation. Again, the points are related, but they are not the same point. Now, here's the interesting piece about how the Bible is sort of different in its context. And that is that both the prohibition of worshiping other gods, on the one hand, and the prohibition on praying with icons on the other, both of those prohibitions run up against standard practice in the ancient Near East, where people worshipped multiple gods and where they used icons, visual representations of the gods they worshipped. There were, in ancient Israel, traditions that developed in which the two ideas were fused together, as is suggested by the Catholic and Lutheran understanding of the first commandment as a one commandment with two parts. This process began with Isaiah, who departed from the idea that other gods were also divine powers of some kind, distinct in some way from Hashem. Isaiah presents them instead as products of human hands. And in seeking alliances with other nations, it's not at all that one is getting entangled with their gods, as it is in Hosea, for example, who's earlier. It's that one is placing one's trust in merely human sources of strength. For Isaiah, if I make a pact with Egypt, I'm essentially making a pact to worship something human. That's not what Hosea is saying. So, in other words, Isaiah is the origin, I think, of the tradition of seeing idols not as warped representations of true gods, but as images of false gods. And then comes the move of identifying these false gods with their images, as if the image were then all there was. So, in a sense, as Gary pointed out, it's actually unfair to those who worship with icons to describe them this way, because most people who worship with icons, as I said earlier, see an icon or an image as a representation of a divine power, which is symbolized by, and maybe even contains some presence of, but does not exhaust the god that it represents. But Israelite iconoclasm, the Israelite rejection of icons, especially in its later stages, sees the image and assumes that the worshiper who uses it is actually bowing down to a mere physical object. This kind of quote-unquote unfair reading becomes the main approach to thinking about images in the Bible. Now, the question is why? And I think that you can say that the idea that an image can represent a deity is disturbing to Jeremiah and those who follow him, because either the image is totally misleading, it gives you the impression that you can just have some kind of physical manifestation that carries the god within it, or it implies that the deity is pathetic. That is, if the image does convey something significant about the god. My point here is not to defend the polemic. It's to understand it. It is, in other words, the interesting philosophical, theological claim, if I'm not mistaken about this, which I might be, that goes for everything I ever say, but I might be mistaken about this, but I think the idea is that any god that can be represented in a physical picture is less than worthy of being God, and therefore is a compromise on true worship. The picture of idolatry as the worship of what human hands made is developed further in the later chapters of Isaiah and in the Psalms, where idolatry is treated as a culpable form of stupidity. Now, it is also the case, I think it's worth noting, that these ideas become stronger in exile when Israelites are a minority culture surrounded by people who worship with icons, and the prophets find this very threatening. And in an attempt to preserve the uniqueness of Israelite religion, one effective way of doing that is to effectively mock the religion of other people. By the way, religious pluralism is not great for Jewish demography. That's even true now. I'm not arguing against religious pluralism. I'm just saying, now I'm going to get in trouble because I know someone here is going to misquote me and it's going to be a catastrophe, and then I'm going to get canceled and the whole thing is going to be very sad for everyone involved, especially me. But I want to say this. If you raised a generation of Jewish children could be completely convinced that Christianity was absurd and stupid, it would be less likely that Jews would convert to Christianity. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Max Rudin, you are going to be my defender here, that say I didn't say what they're going to say that I said, okay? But, you know, saying, well, Judaism is true, but Christianity is true, and so is Islam and Buddhism, which is atheistic. Well, that's true too. How does that work? Who cares? It just works. So for a minority culture under threat, developing an almost caricatured conception of other forms of religious worship may actually be vitally necessary for the survival and preservation of their way of being. In other words, the prohibition on images becomes, I think, a powerful weapon in the Jewish desire to assert Jewish superiority in a time when Jewish inferiority is what is being drilled into them. What better way to do that than to say, yeah, the battle between us is the battle between a living God and lifeless objects. Choose. Which do you want to worship? So I never want to reduce philosophical or theological ideas to historical context, but I do want to situate them there.